Imagine a weapon system that decides who to fire at based entirely on a math equation.
Right.
Or like a perfectly empathetic digital therapist that knows exactly what to say to comfort you, but doesn't actually have a mind or a pulse.
Yeah, it's a wild thought.
Because we've spent, the last few decades treating artificial intelligence like this complex math problem, right?
Yeah.
Calculating the load, optimizing the output. But suddenly, and this is what we're looking at today, that math problem has evolved into a full-blown global moral crisis.
It really is a profound shift. I mean, we are no longer just building systems that automate our spreadsheets. We're deploying systems that actively mimic human thought.
Right.
Systems that are making unilateral decisions about our livelihoods, our geopolitical security, and even our fundamental understanding of reality.
Yeah, the blueprint of like clean, predictable engineering just completely falls apart when you try to apply it to human ethics.
Exactly.
Which brings us to our source material for our deep dive today. It's a brand new, highly anticipated document from 2026, an encyclical letter by Pope Leo XIV.
Titled Magnifica Humanitas.
Right, Magnificent Humanity. Mm. And our mission today is to figure out how this major philosophical text tackles the tech crisis.
Yeah.
How do we safeguard our humanity, our jobs, our truth in this new AI era?
You know, you might not expect a religious institution to produce one of the most blistering critiques of the digital age.
No, definitely not.
But that is exactly what this is.
Yeah, and regardless of your personal background or whether you get, consider yourself a person of faith at all, this document provides this incredibly dense, globally relevant ethical framework.
Oh, for sure.
It reads like a philosophical survival guide for the AI age. It's really tackling that tension between brutal efficiency and messy humanity. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, to understand the specific warnings it gives about algorithms and data monopolies, we first have to grasp the core metaphor the document uses.
Right, the construction projects.
Exactly. It frames technological development not as this inevitable path we're stuck on, but as a deliberate choice between two completely opposed mindsets. And it uses two ancient biblical construction projects to illustrate this.
The Tower of Babel and the rebuilding of Jerusalem.
Right. So first, the Tower of Babel.
The classic cautionary tale.
Yeah. Historically, the people building Babel are trying to construct this massive monolith to the heavens just to make a name for themselves.
Right.
But the document points out that the real danger of Babel wasn't its height. It was its absolute crushing uniformity.
Okay, uniformity.
Yeah, it was a project of sheer dominance. It represents what the text calls a technocratic paradigm.
Meaning what, exactly?
It's the tendency to let the logic of absolute efficiency, centralized control, and profit completely dictate the structure of our lives.
Wow, okay.
In the Babel narrative, there was only one language, one sanctioned technology, one dictated direction. They sacrificed human dignity for the sake of the project's scale.
So the project was the only thing that mattered.
Exactly. Like, if a brick fell and broke, it was a tragedy because it delayed construction. But if a human worker fell and died,
they just swapped them out.
They were simply replaced. The machine, the tower was infinitely more important than the individual people. Diversity was just seen as an inefficiency.
You know, I look at modern tech monopolies and I see the exact same architecture. It's like the difference between a massive top-down corporate algorithm that reduces all of us to data points to be optimized, that's Babel.
Right.
Versus an open source community project where everyone has a voice and agency, that's Jerusalem.
That's a great way to look at it, because if we connect this to the bigger picture, the document is arguing that technology itself isn't inherently evil.
Right. It's just a tool.
Well, but it's never just a neutral tool either.
Oh, okay.
It inevitably takes on the blind spots and the values of the people financing it and designing
it. Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. And the Jerusalem model, where Nehemiah is rebuilding the ruined walls, that was a project of shared responsibility. Everyone rebuilt their own specific section. They brought their own unique skills, building brick by brick.
So valuing the community over sheer scale.
Exactly.
Which means if the people designing our tech are driven by that Babel mindset, seeing humans as just a resource to extract value from, then the AI they build is just going to automate that extraction.
Which leads us directly to how this obsession with tech dominance warps our daily relationship with AI.
The empathy illusion, right?
Yeah, the text dives deep into this. The Babel mindset conditions us to prioritize frictionless efficiency over everything else, even our emotional lives.
Right, because current AI systems, especially large language models, they're incredibly good at simulating human communication.
Oh, they're flawless at it.
They can offer advice. They sound compassionate. They fake empathy perfectly. But the document draws a very hard line here.
It does. It says these systems do not feel, they don't have a body, they don't suffer, they don't mature through the fiction of real relationships.
They definitely don't have a moral conscience.
Right. We're just projecting our own humanity onto an impressive pattern recognition engine. And the document warns this is profoundly dangerous, not just because the machine is faking it, but because of what it does to the human user.
But wait, if an AI companion or therapist helps someone feel less lonely, does it really matter if the AI isn't feeling it? Isn't the end result what counts? I mean, I know a lot of people listening might be thinking exactly that.
And it's a completely valid question. The document addresses this by looking at the long-term psychological impact.
Okay.
The danger isn't that someone will literally think the machine is biological. The danger is that by constantly interacting with perfectly accommodating simulated empathy, we risk losing the desire for genuine human connection.
Wow. We just lose the tolerance for it.
Exactly. Real relationships are messy. They require patience, vulnerability, dealing with another person's flaws.
Right. They take work.
But an AI companion is designed to perfectly mirror you. It never challenges you in a way you don't want. It's always instantly available.
It's like the psychological equivalent of junk food.
Yes.
It hits all the dopamine receptors, tastes great, but there's no nutritional value. And if that's all you eat, you lose your appetite for real food.
That's a perfect analogy.
You start expecting your human friends to act like algorithms, perfectly optimized for your convenience.
And that expectation of optimization bleeds into how we view ourselves, too. The text sharply critiques transhumanism.
The idea that we need to upgrade ourselves.
Right, the cultural movement that views human limitations, aging, weakness, suffering as bugs. Just bugs in our biological hardware that need to be patched by tech.
Yeah, we see this everywhere.
Yeah.
Biohacking our sleep, trying to engineer out all our weaknesses. We are terrified of our own limitations.
But the document argues the exact opposite. It says human finitude isn't a flaw. Our vulnerabilities are exactly what give birth to compassion, generosity, and love.
Right. Because if you never experience pain or failure, how could you ever have genuine compassion for someone else?
Exactly. If you were perfectly self-sufficient, why would you ever build a community? Our limitations are the required architecture for love.
That's beautiful. So if we engineer out our vulnerability, we engineer out our capacity to love, we just become the tower.
We become the machine. And the thing is, while we obsess over whether an AI is simulating feelings for us, we completely ignore the actual suffering humans who make that simulation possible.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because people love to talk about AI as this magical cloud of math, but it's not.
No, the physical infrastructure relies on massive amounts of hidden human suffering. The document unflinchingly calls out these new forms of modern slavery.
Yeah, let's talk about the ghost workers.
What's fascinating here is how the text completely strips away the polished veneer of Silicon Valley. Behind the magic of an AI generating a flawless image, there are millions of unseen workers.
Often young women in developing nations.
Right. Yes. Working in digital sweatshops, doing the deeply traumatic work of data labeling for pennies a day.
They're essentially human filters. Spending hours looking at the most toxic, violent content on the internet just so they can label it.
Right, to teach the algorithm what not to generate.
Their psychological well-being is entirely sacrificed to sanitize our digital experience. And that's just the software side.
The hardware is just as brutal.
Yeah, children mining rare earth minerals like cobalt and lithium in incredibly dangerous conditions just to build the microprocessors for these server farms.
The bodies of the invisible poor are literally being worn down so our computational flow never gets interrupted.
It's just staggering irony. A technology promising total emancipation is actually built on a hidden supply chain of servitude.
And the extraction doesn't stop at physical minerals or cheap labor. The document introduces this concept of digital colonialism.
Right.
In the past, colonial powers extracted physical resources, gold, spices, and dominated bodies. Today, the new rare earth mineral is data.
Let's unpack how that actually works, because it is so insidious. Let's say a powerful tech monopoly offers a free AI-driven health app to rural clinics in the global south.
Sounds philanthropic, right?
Exactly. But every scan, every genetic marker is being sucked out of those communities and aggregated in a server thousands of miles away.
And then the tech company uses that massive free data set to train highly lucrative predictive models, to secure pharmaceutical patents.
And a few years later, when a groundbreaking treatment is developed from that data, The very people who provided the biological raw material can't even afford the medicine.
It transforms personal lives into exploitable information, centralizing power in the hands of a few corporations.
So if the data is our collective human experience, the document is basically saying it can't just be the private property of a few billionaires.
Right. What's fascinating here is how the encyclical applies this old principle of social doctrine called the universal destination of goods.
Okay, what does that mean?
Historically, it meant the Earth's natural resources fundamentally belong to the whole human family. Private property is valid, but secondary to shared human needs.
Got it.
And Magnifica Humanitas fiercely updates this for 2026. It insists that foundational algorithms and massive data sets must be regulated as a shared human good.
Because it's the product of millions of contributors.
Exactly. It shouldn't be hoarded while the ghost workers and the data subjects are left behind.
Okay, but this raises a terrifying point. When this massive, unchecked digital colonialism collides with global politics.
Yeah.
The stakes go from economic exploitation to literal life and death.
Yes. This raises an important question, and it's arguably the most urgent section of the text. The integration of AI into warfare.
Lethal autonomous weapon systems.
Yes. Delegating the decision to take a human life to an algorithm.
Which is horrifying. Because when a human soldier pulls a trigger, there is moral weight.
Exactly. There's hesitation, trauma, and awareness of the gravity of taking a life. That friction is a moral safeguard.
But if you hand that to an opaque algorithm,
the decision isn't a moral act anymore. It becomes a sanitized calculation.
It totally shields the chain of command from any psychological responsibility.
Mm.
The enemy is just a data point to be deleted.
And civilian victims become collateral damage in an optimization formula. The text insists lethal decisions can never be automated. An algorithm cannot understand the value of the life it is ending.
There always has to be a self-aware human in control.
Someone who bears the moral burden and can be held accountable.
And this algorithmic sanitization, it's not just on the physical battlefield. The document dives into information warfare too, right?
Oh, heavily. AI amplifying disinformation at an unprecedented scale, destroying the concept of truth as a common good.
We're seeing the dismantling of shared reality. Deepfakes, manipulated audio, bot networks generating synthetic opinions. Reality just becomes malleable.
People start believing truth is whatever narrative fits their ideology. And when truth is no longer a shared baseline, democratic life breaks down.
Because you can't even debate if you can't agree on basic facts.
Exactly. You're left with polarization and tribalism. The encyclical warns this actively paves the way for totalitarianism. Because if nothing is objectively true, the only thing that matters is raw power.
Whoever has the best algorithm forces their reality on everyone else.
Right.
So what does this all mean? I mean, it feels incredibly overwhelming. Automated warfare, disinformation pipelines, monopolies extracting our DNA, the Babel Tower is basically touching the clouds at this point.
Yeah.
How is everyday people listening right now, how are we supposed to push back against this?
Well, the document doesn't leave us in despair. It gives a very specific, provocative call to action. We must disarm AI.
I love that phrase, disarm the machine.
It sounds cinematic, but it's incredibly practical. Disarming AI doesn't just mean banning drones. It means fundamentally changing the culture around how tech is built.
Freeing it from the cutthroat competition.
Right. Discrediting the assumption that whoever has the most technical capability automatically gets to govern our lives.
We have to pull these systems out of corporate secrecy.
Subject them to democratic oversight. Mandate transparency. Protect the ghost workers. Technology has to serve the human person, not the other way around.
And this brings the whole framework right back to your daily life. Because it's easy to listen to this and think, I'm just one person. I have no influence over Silicon Valley. But the point of Magnifica Humanitas is that we are all on the construction site of this new era.
You are part of the building project. Your choices dictate which city is being built.
Every time you pause to verify a piece of information before you share it, you're defending truth. Every time you choose a messy, genuine human interaction over a simulated digital one, you're resisting the empathy illusion.
Every time you advocate for data privacy, you are making a deliberate choice.
You're laying a brick for Nehemiah's Jerusalem, refusing to hand another brick to the Tower of Babel.
It's a daily refusal to let efficiency define the value of your life.
Exactly. And to leave you with one final lingering thought today, there's this brilliant observation near the end of the text. It looks at the difference between how an algorithm handles an error and how a human handles a mistake.
For an algorithm, an error is just a flaw.
Right, a bug to be optimized and deleted.
It holds no value. It's just an inefficiency to be erased so the machine runs faster.
But for a human being, an error is entirely different. Our mistakes, our failures, they aren't bugs. They are the exact catalysts for profound change. They're the prerequisites for forgiveness.
Recognizing our errors is what builds empathy.
It's what gives us true moral freedom. So the question we want you to mull over is this. In our rush to use AI to optimize our lives and eliminate all our mistakes, are we at risk of engineering out the very errors that make us human? Thanks for diving deep with us.